Kopf der Woche Podcast.
Willkommen in der Podcast-Version von Kopf der Woche. Mein Name ist Egon Huschitt und ich bin in Südafrika. Mein Gast heute ist Terry Crawford Brown, früher Banker, der zum Friedensaktivisten wurde. Er hat mit Erzbischof Desmond Tutu die Kampagne zur Sanktionierung von Banken gegen das Apartheid-System in Südafrika initiiert, um so einen Bürgerkrieg in Südafrika zu verhindern. Er ist außerdem bekannt als Whistleblower im südafrikanischen Rüstungs- und Waffenskandal. Seit 1967 lebt er in Südafrika und ist heute mein Gast. Wir führen das Gespräch auf Englisch.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You was born in Ireland in 1942, but grew up in Libya from 1946 until 1960.
Yeah.
How did that come?
As you know, Libya was an Italian colony before the Second World War. And during and after the war, my father was appointed as for the British Provincial Administration of Tripolitania as Commissioner of Trade and Supplies until the United Nations decided in 1951 that Libya would be independent as three provinces united as Libya. And so we were initially meant to be there for 2 years, but we stayed for 15. After independence, oil companies started coming in. So he was involved in supplying oil companies with everything from food to vehicles, whatever they needed as part of the exploration. And then oil actually was discovered in 1960. He then had medical problems and needed to go back to Ireland. And his older brother then invited me to go to the United States to go to university.
So this is what you did before you joined Archbishop Tutu, or what did you do in between?
So then I went to university in the States. And after graduating from university, I came to South Africa intending to spend 2 years here and then to return to the States. But then I met a South African woman and I got married, and these things happen when you're 24. And so I needed a job. So I worked for a gold mining company in Johannesburg. And this, by then it was the 1968, when there was a lot of discussion about whether the gold price should be increased from $35 to $70 to reflect the cost of the U.S. wars in Vietnam and elsewhere. And that was really the peak of gold production in South Africa. South Africa was mined about three-quarters of all the gold ever mined in the world, mined in South Africa. So after 2 years in Johannesburg, I returned to the States, and there went into international banking, and of course it was the beginning of the turbulence in foreign exchange markets. President Nixon in 1971 so-called closed the gold window, so a lot of turbulence in foreign exchange markets, and so that's how I went into international banking. But then I was recruited by Nedbank to return to South Africa in 1974. And so after 2 years in Johannesburg, I had 5 years in Durban, and then 1981, I came to Cape Town.
And so how do you turn from a banker to a peace activist?
Well, even a banker has teenage sons. And my teenage son was supposed to be conscripted into the army, the apartheid army. And I said, there's no way he's going into the apartheid army. So I became a supporter of the end conscription campaign. And we then had the cadet system at the school he was going to. It became voluntary instead of mandatory. When they said he had to register, I said I refused to allow him to register, and so he escaped conscription. But he went to a church school, an Anglican church school. So the next thing I knew, I was appointed as one of the Anglican church representatives to the Western Province Council of Churches. And just at the time when there was a lot of turmoil developing in South Africa, I was regional treasury manager for Nedbank. And then in 1985, August 85, President P.W. Botha, in his Rubicon speech, in effect told the world to go to hell. We're not going to listen to the world. We had a financial crash. I had a transaction going through a few days later, at the end of August 1985, for 120 million Deutschmarks that I had bought from a shipping company here who had sold a passenger ship to East Germany. Apartheid South Africa wasn't meant to be dealing with East Germany, but nonetheless, we sold them a passenger ship, and the payment came in to Dresdner Bank Düsseldorf. But when we instructed our bankers in New York to transfer the dollars, it was just about $60 million, to Barclays Bank New York for account of Safmarine, they grabbed our $60 million, and the whole New York bank system, payment system just imploded. And so the church leaders here said, whoa, if we can do this in New York from Cape Town, that's the pressure point, it's a non-violent initiative. So they sent me off to New York, where first to Geneva, London, New York, and Washington. And at the United Nations, Archbishop Tutu, or then Bishop Tutu, and I launched the banking sanctions campaign as a means of putting pressure on the government because of the role of the US dollar as settlement currency in foreign exchange markets. So there were seven major New York banks that we targeted, because if you didn't have access to their payment system, you wouldn't be able to trade with Europe or Japan and so forth. And thankfully, it worked. You know, by 1989, Cold War was coming to an end. We had perestroika. We were no longer communists. you know, they kept saying, what is this conservative white banker doing with these communist churchmen like Tutu? And so then people were picking it up, and the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act had been passed in Washington, which Reagan vetoed. It was passed over his veto. So the United Nations, the Commonwealth, were realizing the banking pressure was how to apply pressure against the apartheid government. And then, so 89 was a crazy year. There were all kinds of things happening here and internationally. And in fact, in Cape Town, we had the March for Peace in September 1989, when 35,000 people marched from St. George's Cathedral to the City Hall, led by Archbishop Tutu. And de Klerk, after that, had lost the initiative. And as Tutu loves to say, we marched in Cape Town, and the Berlin Wall fell down 2 months later. So give us the credit for the Berlin Wall also falling down. And there is a piece of the Berlin Wall opposite St. George's Cathedral. It's a donation from the city of Berlin.
Great. And now you wrote numbers of books. Your book, Eye on the Money and Eye on the Diamond, was published by Penguin Books. Your new book title is Eye on the Gold. What is this about?
Well, it's because gold was really the basis of South Africa's economic development. From 1886 until 1926, gold was really the basis of the British sterling system. And it was considered to be essential to support any wars and whatever. And by the end of the First World War, Britain was bankrupt, but the financial system was moving from London to New York because Britain had borrowed so much. And Winston Churchill in 1925 insisted on going back to the gold standard at the pre-war price values, and a financial catastrophe resulted, the crash, the depression, and so forth. And that really was the end of the beginning of the end of the British Empire, because its financial system just fell apart. But it then impacted in the States, the depression. President Roosevelt came to office. He devalued the dollar from $20.67 to $35. And bit by bit, the US came out of depression. And then the gold price was continued to be fixed at $35 an ounce during the Bretton Woods system. And so that continued until 1971, when President Nixon closed the gold window. But then in 1973, Henry Kissinger negotiated with Saudi Arabia so that all OPEC oil is priced in US dollars only. And so we've moved essentially from a gold system to a black gold system. The world is on a Saudi Arabian oil basis to prop up the dollar, so that if people like Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or Hugo Chavez start saying they want payment in euros or in gold or whatever, the next thing we have is regime change. That system is beginning to fall apart. So the question is, will follow it? It'll be a new era. People of your generation no longer think of gold as money. Gold is jewelry. And so the old idea of a gold standard is now no longer relevant in the 21st century. So we'll have a new system. And at this point, I'm just raising a question mark. What will that new system be? Obviously, internet, digital currencies, and things of that nature.
But one part of the book is decided to the army deals back in the 1980s. What is that about?
Well, because we had gold, we thought in South Africa that we were impregnable. that the rest of the world might not like apartheid, but gold was such we could do what we wanted. But already the gold production was beginning to falter, and the Reserve Bank mismanaged the whole system. And as I say, the banking sanctions campaign really proved, was the beginning of the end, coincided with the beginning of the end of the gold industry in South Africa. It's then diminished hugely, so we're now number 8th in the world. And most of the gold mines are closing. And now, although we still have a lot of gold ore in the country, it's increasingly dangerous, too expensive, and the gold mining may even close down. It's no longer economically viable for most mines in this country. So that gold era is passing, but what it has left in South Africa is the legacies of apartheid with migrant labor, huge environmental issues, huge social issues, HIV involved. So that's one of the, amongst the legacies that we have coming out of the gold era. It's left a huge, huge amount of problems in South Africa. We've got to move on to other issues. But what it did lead was, the perception that South Africa was impregnable. And so that during the 1980s, we had the UN arms embargo from 1977, that it was illegal to export weapons to South Africa. But companies like Rheinmetall flouted that. They shipped an entire ammunition factory from Germany to Paraguay. When it got to Brazil, it was reshipped and sent to South Africa and was very, very active during the 1980s in shipping ammunition to Iraq for Saddam Hussein.
But how exactly did that work?
Well, after 1979, of course, with the revolution in Iran, when the Shah was deposed, the gold price briefly rocketed to $800, and then the Americans intervened. They increased their interest rates, and the gold price then collapsed. And with that, the rand began to weaken very. So South Africa was already weakened by that. But the Americans, even in 1979, were so incensed that the Iranians had had a revolution and deposed the Shah. And then you had that whole issue of 52 diplomats being stuck in the American embassy for over 400 days. So they deliberately instigated a war between Iraq and Iran, which ran for 8 years. And the Americans and the Israelis were supplying weapons to Iran, and Iran was buying American weapons on the black market. But other countries, including Germany, South Africa, England, France, were encouraged by the Americans and the CIA to supply weapons to Iraq. The Americans supported Saddam Hussein against Iran. And it went on until 1980. And then in 1980, by then, Iraq was $70 billion in debt. It then decided to annex Kuwait because Kuwait had lots of financial resources. So suddenly the world changes. Saddam Hussein is a monster. We don't want to admit that we had anything to do with Iraq. So everyone changed tune. So then 1991, we have a war against Iraq and the first Gulf War and now the second Gulf War and so forth. So the Western powers put huge resources into supplying Saddam Hussein in the 80s with massive consequences that we still haven't dealt with.
You're also writing about the crash of the SAA Helderberg, where 159 passengers and crew was killed. What is your take on that?
Well, as part of this, during the 1980s, as I say, the CIA was encouraging South Africa to supply weapons to Iraq, including missile technology. There was ammunition, but there was missile technology and so forth. And a company in the States was supplying the technology to a plant on the fringe of Cape Town in Somerset West. And business was so good. We had about $4.5 billion worth of exports to Iraq in those days, and Iraq was paying with oil because we had an oil embargo, so we needed the oil and they needed the armaments. And business was so good that part of the plant was closed temporarily for expansion. They were producing the ingredients for rocket fuel. So at that time, that ammonium perchlorate was being imported from the United States to Taiwan. It was put on a passenger plane, which was a combination of cargo and passenger. And the weather was turbulent after they took off from Taipei. The plane caught fire near Singapore. The crew thought they'd put the fire out, but the pilot asked for it to make an emergency landing, and he was instructed by Johannesburg no to fly on to Mauritius, a second fire, and by then there's nothing to fight it, so the plane crashed. And huge cover-up here in the first inquiry. And then in 1997, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission had another investigation, and they said the investigation was incomplete. They were about to close at that time, but they recommended further investigation. In the meantime, from 1991 until 1997, there were negotiations between Vice President Al Gore and Deputy President Thabo Mbeki about the collusion of the CIA and sanctions busting and so forth. And my take on this from various research is that Gore and Mbeki decided to put the lid on this. It was a gagging order. And so although relatives have been pushing for more than 30 years for an investigation, there's always silence.
And let's talk about how South Africa is these days dealing with this heritage.
Yeah, well, with the lifting of the arms embargo in 1994, it was the end of the Cold War, so companies like British Aerospace were facing bankruptcy. So they, even before the arms embargo was lifted, they were lobbying already to sell weapons, warships, warplanes to the post-apartheid government. And I was appointed then to represent the Anglican Church at the Defence Review in Parliament, and we said, thankfully, there's no conceivable foreign threat to South Africa. The threat is poverty, the legacies of apartheid. We must put everything we can into education, health, and job creation, and housing. Thankfully, we are overarmed because of the apartheid era. We don't need more weapons. But the European governments, the British, the Germans, the Swedes, the French, put massive pressure on this government to buy. And the idea was if we spent $5 billion on warships and warplanes, they would invest back $18 billion in offsets that would create 65,000 jobs and stimulate the economy. So from my banking background, I knew offsets were just an invitation to corruption. And I said so at the Defense Review and publicly in writings and so forth. But the government insisted, oh no, we were going to have such an economic boom coming out of buying weapons. Well, what it has done is, I've been vindicated, it unleashed this culture of corruption that we have. And it's not just the arms deal, it's now the ESCOMs and all these state institutions that have been riddled with corruption, sadly. And what has done is really to jeopardize what we thought would be our new constitutional democracy. And now that really hangs in the balance. We hope we can get back to where we thought we'd be in 94, 96. But it's really shameful that European governments put such pressure on our government, a very naive and inexperienced government, to buy warships and warplanes. And for instance, with the British and Swedish, we have borrowed for 20 years. We haven't yet paid for them, but we have no pilots to fly them, because the pilots have all left for commercial airlines overseas. We've no mechanics left. The planes are useless. And likewise, the submarines, they're not maintained. The submarines we bought from Germany.
Your book is not only about the arms deal and what came out of it. What other topics do you raise in the book?
Well, I raise, for instance, the matter of Rheinmetall. Because with the transition, and in 2008, Rheinmetall bought a 51% interest in Denel Munitions, which has a plant on the fringe of Cape Town in Somerset West, and where a lot of very dubious things went on during the 80s and 90s, and the Americans closed down much of it. We don't know the full extent of it because it's been secret. But it was included investigation in depleted uranium and missile technology, and we had ambitions to launch satellites and so forth. A lot of that's been closed down. But Rheinmetall in 2008 bought a 51% interest in Donnell Munitions, and they deliberately site their production in countries like South Africa where the rule of law is a bit weak, and 85% of their production is for export to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, UAE, where, of course, there's been a huge uproar internationally, particularly since the murder of Khashoggi, and Saudi UAE war crimes in Yemen. And then in 2018, there was an explosion at Rheinmetall, and 8 workers were killed. And so this has raised the whole issue here. And so in June last year, the government here put a suspension on exports of weapons to the Middle East. So now the arms companies are saying, but what about the jobs? I was given a proxy vote to attend the Rheinmetall AGM in Berlin in May, and we asked questions, what's going to happen? Oh, it's going to be fully automated, so then there won't be jobs. Well, what about the contamination? An ammunition factory is notoriously contaminated, and this is in a residential area. It shouldn't be there, when it was initially built, it was in the country, but now it's in a residential area. We need to have it cleaned up. We need to then reuse that land. It's a huge area of land of about 3,000 hectares. And the question would be whether that land could be redeveloped for instance, sustainable energy. How do we create more jobs? Because given the unemployment situation in this country, it's critical that we also look at the job consequences as well as the environmental consequences. And so we're looking at Rheinmetall there. As to why should we get involved in collusion with supplying Saudi Arabia or UAE, or now they're talking about, in fact, we hear they're exporting because they can no longer export to Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're exporting to Turkey. Well, Turkey's got many human rights issues within Turkey, but then it's involved in a war with Syria and war in Libya. But the supplies are coming from South Africa.
Let's talk shortly about fighting corruption in South Africa. How would you describe the situation now, fighting corruption here?
Well, sadly, the government talks about fighting corruption and does nothing. In all countries of the world, no country has really resolved how do you fund political parties. And it is governments that buy weapons. So the armaments industry is estimated to be responsible for about 45% of world corruption and kickbacks to political parties and so forth. And 20 years ago, when I was involved with this, I was told by ANC intelligence operatives that these people were making major donations to the ANC in return for political protection. So no charges were ever investigated and things of that nature. Now suddenly the government is waking up as to what it's done to our economy and to unemployment and so forth. They're saying, oh, now we should investigate corruption. Internationally, it's accepted that there is no prescription on fraud. The remedy for fraud is you cancel the contracts, you return the goods, and you get the money back. Now, these contracts were in fact guaranteed in respect of Germany by Hermes, and in Britain by the ECGD, which is now known as UK Finance. So we would like to send some rather used submarines back to Germany and planes back to Sweden and England. We certainly need the money, but it's a little unlikely, but that's what we'd like to dream for.
Terry Crawford Brown, thanks for joining us and thanks for your insights. More on your book, Eye on the Gold.
Yes, well, I thought I was going to write it 5 years ago, when I took Zuma to the Constitutional Court. And then I decided to wait until now. It is semi-autobiographical, given the experiences I've had in this crazy country. It's an amazing place. Anything can happen here, and does. that you'd never find anywhere else in Europe. And people knew, wow, what kind of a country is this? It's a fascinating place to live in, and so many contradictions. And it's been a privilege. My wife was Archbishop Tutu's secretary right through the 1980s and then subsequently the TRC. So we've had these insights through the archbishops, working closely with the archbishop, that would be most unusual for white South Africans. And so Iron the Gold is also that experience of through the 80s with the banking sanctions campaign, the corruption of the arms deal, and how, okay, in respect of the banking sanctions campaign, how we successfully used nonviolence to overcome a very, very entrenched, violent and militaristic government. And it's really the only instance where sanctions have worked. The Americans have been putting sanctions on Cuba since the 1950s, and all they've done is create hardship for the people, but never have achieved any objective. Whereas we targeted the banks, because the banks are part of the elite, and they can tell the government, hey, the game's up, you better negotiate, which is what happened here.
Terry, thanks again, and dear viewer, also thanks for joining us. Have a good day, see you soon.
Kopf der Woche, Podcast.